This is Focus 580, our morning talk program here on AM 580. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls. Last year, the Food and Drug Administration approved a medication to treat heart failure in African Americans. And this was a first. Never before had a drug been approved for use by a specific racial group. And when that happened, it seemed to add some new energy to a kind of debate that really was not new, all surrounding the question of race. What is it? What do we mean by race? Is it real? Is it a social construct? Is it a biological reality? And at that time, a lot of the stories about the approval of this drug quoted the man who was our guest here in this part of Focus 580, because he's an academic researcher who has thought a lot and read a lot and spoken a lot about these very issues. Our guest is Troy Duster. He is a sociologist at New York University and is particularly interested in sociology of science and knowledge and also race and ethnicity, and is often called upon to comment on these issues. He's the author of a number of books, and I want to just mention a couple of recent ones because they do touch on some of the topics we'll be talking about this morning, particularly his book Backdoor to Eugenics, which was published actually in an updated edition, a second edition, in 2003. Routledge is the publisher, author. He's also the author of the book Whitewashing Race, The Myth of a Colorblind Society, published by University of California Press in 2003. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about this very issue, or some of these issues, that is, the meaning of race in both science and society. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that just so that we can keep moving and get in as many different callers as possible. People who are listening, though, are welcome into the conversation. We're certainly interested in your participation. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. And also, we do have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, we certainly welcome people into the conversation. Again, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Professor Duster, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm fine.
Good. Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. Just the thing I suppose that we might start with is the case of Bidil, this drug that we've talked about.
Yes.
That got a good deal of attention. And this was, I believe this was just last June of 2005, sort
correct,
of last year, that it was approved. And this, for a number of reasons, for obvious reasons, had got a lot of attention because nothing like this had ever happened before. Do you want to talk just a little bit about the background here to this?
Right. Well, it's impossible to exaggerate the importance of this because, as you indicate, at no other point in the history of the Food and Drug Administration have they approved a drug designed for a particular racial group. So we have to go back a little bit in the history and explain what happened. This drug came to market because of peculiarity in the patent law. Bidil is a combination drug designed to treat those who have had certain kinds of heart problems. And in the original trial in the early 90s, this drug was set up. It was a trial, and it was not race specific. It was for everybody, and it turned out that the FDA decided this was not a drug they would approve because they felt that the other drugs on the market did as good a job, the ACE inhibitors. However, a few years later, they went back. The people who designed the drug went back, and they saw in the clinical trial that African Americans seemed to have a better response. So they went back to the FDA and they said, well, why don't you give us approval for a drug trial for African Americans? Now, here's the important feature of this story. The FDA approved this trial even though it was designed only for African Americans. There were no whites, no Asians, no other group. So 1,050 African Americans who had certain kinds of heart problems, which were diagnosed clinically, were part of this trial. And for 2 years, 3 years, the trial went on. And then about 2003, 2004, somewhere in there, they began to see that this drug seemed to be highly efficacious, and it was actually helping the people so much so that they called an end to the trial, and they said it would be unethical to continue this work without giving it to everybody. So at that point, they went back to the Food and Drug Administration, and as you indicated, in June 2005, the FDA approved the drug. So that's the quick history. Now, the feature of the story, which I suppose is not well understood, is patent law. The patent for this drug is critical because in 2007, next year, the general Bidol drug patent was going to expire. And if they made it race-specific, it extends to 2020. So by making it race-specific, they increased the patent by 13 years. So that, I think, is an important feature of the story as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, then that, I guess, gets at one of a number of points, and I know you've made it in a number of the articles that I have read about this, that part of what this is all about is simply marketing.
Yes. You know, the idea that we're going to have specific drugs designed to come to us as individuals. We're going to have our own individualized genomic markers. Now, that's part of the selling point of the human genome revolution. The trouble is, markets are not for individuals. Markets are for groups. And so what's happening now is we're going to see many more of these kinds of thrusts. For example, there's a drug called Iressa. It's a drug for late-stage cancer. And just as with Bidol, this drug was a failure in terms of the whole population. But when it came to looking at the drug's effect upon Asians, it turns out that Asians had a 5-month increased lifespan with this drug. And so the company, AstraZeneca, went back and said, well, wait a minute, but without calling this trial a failure, why don't we call it a success in terms of Asians? And in the last period, they've now moved some of their apparatus in advertising to looking at the issue for Asian Americans and for Asians. So, yes, I mean, I think marketing is key here.
Mm-hmm. And I think it should not surprise us if not only might we see more of that when we're talking about prescription medications, but who knows, maybe even over-the-counter. And in fact, there's a story here I have just from a couple of months ago in Newsday about somebody who wants to market a line of vitamins.
Yes.
With ethnic specificity. That is, he's got a vitamin for white people, he's got a vitamin for black people, he's got a vitamin for Latinos, and he's claiming that the makeup of the vitamin is different because he says different ethnic groups required, you know, different amounts of different things. So he's actually got a multiracial multivitamin.
Well, that is clearly marketing, because there's no evidence at all that you can prescribe a different kind of there's no evidence at all that vitamins are absorbed differently by different groups, different racial groups. Mm-hmm. And so what he's doing is taking advantage of the Bidol story and saying, now we're going to have drugs for whites, blacks, and Latinos. And I should add here that Latinos are obviously a language group. So why would you expect that a particular drug or a vitamin would be good for a language group?
Yeah. I think your quote in the article was something like, so you have a black person who speaks Spanish, so which vitamin is he supposed to take?
Exactly right.
Well, this I think this gives one an opportunity to ask some larger questions about race, about what we mean by it. And I think that there I can understand people being a little confused, at least that modern genetic research seems to be telling us some things about race. The problem is that they contradict one another, because on the one hand, we have scientists saying that, well, now that we've taken a look at the human genetic makeup and we look at DNA, we can say that human beings are essentially the same. There's no difference. Our DNA, yours, mine, everybody's, is 99.9% the same. So on the one hand, they're saying to us, we're all alike, there's no race, there's just the human race, except we're not. You know, so it's sort of on the one hand. On the other hand,
right,
they're saying, we're all alike, except, well, maybe we're not. I understand people being really confused about this.
I think I can bring a little bit of clarity to that discussion. In the first 10 years of the Human Genome Project, that was indeed what people were saying, that you cannot distinguish different human racial groups based upon the DNA. And indeed, if you remember the early conversations about this project, it didn't matter whose genome you sequenced. It could be a white person, a black person, Asian, Aboriginal. It didn't matter because we're all so much alike. That was the first 10 years, 1989 to 1999. Then what happened was that the supercomputer comes into play. And this 99.9% figure is a good figure for most work. However, when it comes to looking for human differences, human variation, human differentiation, now we have a supercomputer that can go into the DNA and look for this 1% difference. And I don't want to get too technical here, but let's say there are 3 billion base pairs in the human genome, 3 billion. But that means that there are 3 million or more points of difference for any two people. And when you put that in a computer, and you ask the computer to search for these, what are they called, patterns of single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs, what happens then is that you can then tell the computer to find differences between any groups of people. And what happened in 2000 was a supercomputer began to show up that you could find these patterns of differences between, quote, racial groups. Now, here I have to be very careful with my language because it could easily be confusing. If you tell a supercomputer to find the difference between people who, let's say, who live in Chicago and those who live in Los Angeles, the computer will find differences. That's because with 3 billion base pairs and 3 million points of difference, that computer will find SNP patterns which are different in Chicago than in Los Angeles. But no one would say that those are racial differences. However, if you have a group of white people and black people and you find differences, you say, oh, these must be racial differences. So I think what's happening here in the last 5 or 6 years is that the supercomputer has been able to develop in a field called pharmacogenomics to bring to bear what we talked about earlier, a consideration of markets. You can market a drug to different, quote, racial or ethnic groups. You can't market a drug to Chicago or L.A. In terms of, quote, biological makeup.
Well, I am sure that people who work in the field of pharmacogenomics, if we ask them about what they're all about, they're going to say, well, look, we're just about improving public health, you know, and if somehow we can, by doing this work, if we can improve people's health by developing medications that are specifically tailored to them and we can lengthen their life and increase their quality of life, well, what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that. Indeed, I'm in favor of this particular drug, Bidil, being on the market. What I object to is that it's marketed to a particular group for which there is no systematic evidence that it's better for that group than another group. For example, there clearly will be white people and Asians who will benefit from Bidil. But being marketed as it is for African Americans, some physicians will see that and they'll say, well, okay, I have this person in my office and they're suffering from this particular problem with heart failure or hypertension, but this person is white. So I won't give them Bidil, I'll give them ACE inhibitors. That's where I think the problem lies. Not that the drug is on the market. I'm in favor of drug developments, which might help people. One would be irresponsible to suggest that once you pull this drug off the market, it helps people. As indeed I've said in interviews, my brother takes this combination drug. Mm-hmm. So I'm in favor of this drug. Let me be clear then that what I'm suggesting is that the problem is not that the drug's on the market, but it's marketed for people of racial distinction.
So it's sort of my understanding that what this does, it specifically addresses the levels of nitrous oxide that are, yes, in people's blood, and that you want to have that there because it helps to open up blood vessels, and African Americans tend to have lower levels of nitrous oxide. So,
well, that's a theory.
There's really no, we're not sure about that.
In order to make that empirically verifiable, you'd need to have what's called a case-controlled study. You'd get 1,000 blacks, 1,000 whites, 1,000 whatever group, and compare them for their levels of NO deficiency. That hasn't been done. Remember, the original study was not designed for racial controls, and the second study was only on African Americans. So we can't make a definitive statement about whether or not blacks have systematically a higher or lower level. And I should remind your audience that most people know this. In America, we have the one-drop rule, which means that you call someone a black person, and they can be, by biological or with genetic stamps in terms of a country of origin, they could have come primarily from European ancestry. So to call someone black in terms of the biology of this gets us right back into what you called at the very beginning of the program, the issue of race. To what extent we're going to call someone black is not so much, therefore, a biological issue. It's about combination of the phenotype as you look at someone, which is not very often definitive, and it's also self-report data.
So just to underscore the point you make, one of your concerns would be that if we start thinking this way about healthcare, and if we do, for example, if we have a physician and he treats people who have heart disease,
yes,
and we have medications that we're somehow encouraging the physician to think this is a black medicine, this is a white medicine. My patient in front of me is black, we'll give him the black medicine. Patient in front of me is white, we give him the white medicine. So it sounds like your concern is going beyond that. That what that does is whether you're deliberately thinking that way or not, what it does do, it gets you back into thinking that my patients are not all just individuals from one to the next, but that I'm going to start thinking of people, start grouping people again and start thinking, well, that maybe there's some way that my black patients are all one way and my white patients are all one way and my Asian patients are all one way. And it gets you back into thinking about race in a way that it seems that we had started to get away from.
Yes, that's exactly right. Indeed, there are a lot of medical errors which are we've documented. The IOM study a few years ago said there were over 105,000 deaths per year from medical errors. About 10,000 of those are misdiagnosed heart problems. And it's my considered opinion that if you start putting race into this mix in terms of diagnosing who has, who does not have an NO deficiency, then I think you're going to increase those number of errors, not decrease them. So, yes, I mean, I think that at heart here of the matter is whether or not by using race as a proxy for the delivery of medicine, we increase medical errors. I'm in favor of people putting on the market drugs that help reduce NO deficiency. That's a good thing. Hmm. So the issue is whether or not, having done that and prescribed it only, quote, for black people, unquote, one is making possibly a medical error.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour, Troy Duster. He's professor of sociology at New York University. And is it you also still also at UCLA?
I have what's called a courtesy appointment at the University of California at Berkeley, where I'm a chancellor's professor.
Berkeley, okay. And this is certainly these issues, race and ethnicity, are some that he has written a lot about and spoken a lot about. He's also interested in sociology of science and of knowledge, and has often called upon to comment on these issues, and certainly last June, June of 2005, when this medication that we've been talking about was approved, he was quoted in many of the stories, many of the stories that I read about it. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. It seems to be that in some ways, genetic science has put us back in a way. In some ways, it has knocked us back a couple of steps, I think, in the way that we think about race. That is, assuming that you think that at that point where we were saying everybody was all alike, that was a good thing. And that seems that's really the in a sense, one of the points that you make in Backdoor to Eugenics. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think it's complicated. On the one end, I don't want to characterize the field of molecular biology as having pushed us back on the issue of race. I think there is, for example, a debate inside the field. There are some people in molecular biology who think that one should not be using racial categories in the analysis of the DNA. There was a big debate in 2000 in Washington between the people in the field doing what we call the haplotype map, which was step two of the Human Genome Project. Now, in that debate, the question was, do we leave on these stored tissue samples ethnic and racial markers? And this is not a debate, again, outside science. This is a debate inside the corridor. And I was fascinated to hear the kinds of arguments that were being used. And many of the people in molecular biology are quite sophisticated. And they said that race is a full category. You know, you go back 880 years, to year, let's say 1920, and there were over 25 different categories. People were using Aryan race and Jewish race and Slavic race, Ethiopian race. By the middle of the 20th century, we had gotten it down back again to the original four categories of Linnaeus in 1756. Race is therefore quite fluid, and I don't want to characterize the whole field of molecular biology as in any sense being retrograde here. I mean, I think one could say that at least half to two-thirds of the field would say that race is primarily a concept which is a folk concept. Now, what people will then tell you, people like Neil Risch will say, but it's a proxy for ancestry. So if I can look at someone and determine that they're probably from sub-Saharan Africa as opposed to Asia, as opposed to Europe, maybe I'll have a better understanding of something about their ancestry, and that's relevant to their possible manifestation of certain kinds of problems or diseases. On a contingent way, that's true. I mean, for example, everyone knows that in America, people from African descent from the western part are at higher risk for sickle cell anemia, and people from Europe are at higher risk for cystic fibrosis and so on. So in a crude way, one can say, even though biologists have said it's not, in quote, relevant in the DNA level, for some purposes, race is a proxy for high risk for certain kinds of diseases. So I want to acknowledge that point, that it's not simply entirely to be said as a social construct. On the other hand, the danger is that people will say, oh, I see, sickle cell is a black disease. In fact, it is not. It's a disease that comes about because people have lived near malarial lakes or conditions. And if you have sickle cell trait, you have some greater immunity from malaria. So people from the Mediterranean, there's certain parts of Greece, there's certain parts of the Arabian Peninsula, which have high rates of sickle cell. So sickle cell itself in the U.S. may seem to be, quote, a black disease, but in worldwide terms, it cannot be racialized.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Others who are listening are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller is in Urbana, here where we are, and online number one. Hello.
Hello. Well, your guest has begun to approach the topic I wanted to see examined, the definition of race. What troubles me is that, in popular terms at least, race is largely a matter of skin pigmentation, which is extremely variable. You can see that if you examine any population over a north-south determinant of some size, northern Chinese are quite fair, well, quite light-skinned. Southern Chinese are darker. The same thing holds true for Europe, generally. Population movements, of course, disturb this. I think you would find that over most areas. Africa, the climate is such that it perhaps is less apparent. The other thing is that within the so-called black race, you have more genetic variation than you have among the rest of humanity, which to me would say if there was such a construct as race, there must be multiple races within Africa. But I think that would be a rather unprofitable pursuit trying to determine that.
The caller is exactly right. We've known for a long time that the greatest amount of human genetic variation is in sub-Saharan Africa. So in those terms alone, you'd expect to see much more variation in human expression of certain kinds of problems or diseases or health issues. What's different is that in the migration out of Africa in the last three centuries, people from sub-Saharan Africa have had the greatest kind of homogeneous experience in terms of their social existence. So whether you're in Brazil or in the Caribbean or in the U.S. Or even in Europe now, people from sub-Saharan Africa tend to be at the base of the economic social structure. So what's common is their social experience. What's remarkably different is their, quote, genetic variation.
I would suspect that if you were to go back 200 years, you would find many of the same problems in the low economic status groups in Europe that you now find in part of the Afro-American population in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly it's true that people living in poverty in Europe in the 18th and 19th century has higher rates of crime and higher rates of disease and mental illness and so forth. So you're quite right about that.
The degree of population mixing also seems to... people somehow, I think, equate race with breeds of livestock. But it's quite an improper parallel because human beings are very indiscriminate in who they choose for mates.
That's on biological grounds, but of course, anthropologically, that's not true. People are extraordinarily selective in who they're permitted to marry and who they're permitted to have children with. I mean, you're right in terms of a long history of several hundred years of people living near each other. But in general, you know, the extraordinary strong rules about endogamy in every culture.
Well, your point is well taken. I apologize. In the long term, I think I'm right, but...
Indeed.
Well, I'm enjoying your discussion, and we'll continue to.
All right, well...
Thank you very much.
Other comments or questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I recognize this question perhaps is backtracking just a little bit, but again, I guess I'm interested in going back to that... that notion that at one point scientists, genetic scientists, were saying to us that essentially, as far as science is concerned, based on now what we know about people's genetic makeup, as far as science is concerned, race doesn't mean anything. Let's leave aside the social construct because we know that it is, and I want to talk about that. But if we're not going to hold to that, if we're going to say, well, I'm not sure we can say that anymore. It's not that it doesn't mean anything. Then perhaps the question is, as far as science is concerned, well, what does it mean?
Well, here's the problem. It's a catch-22. As soon as you leave ethnic and racial markers on genetic tissue samples, as soon as you say, we're going to go into the DNA and look for patterns, let's take prostate cancer. It's a good example because in the United States, prostate cancer is higher among African Americans than among whites. I think the rate is about 2.5, or certainly at least 2-1, higher rates of prostate cancer. Well, if you're at the Institute for Cancer Research and you have those data, and you may say, well, let's go into a sample of, quote, blacks with black DNA and see if we can find some patterns in the DNA to explain why this might be the case. Now, here's the danger. As I said earlier in the program, a supercomputer will find these SNP patterns between any two groups chosen almost at random. Because with 3 million difference points between any two people, the computer will be told, find those and make a pattern of them. So what can happen in this kind of research with prostate cancer? It can come up with false positives. It can come up with research which says, okay, there are SNP patterns on chromosome 7 or 8, and they look different than they do for whites. Now, here's the part that I think is vital to this discussion. When we say that we found differences in the DNA, those differences are not necessarily in what are called the coding regions, where the genes will tell the cells to code for certain things and to do certain things. It's simply... it's in the non-coding region that we're finding many of these patterns. And I think that our listeners need to really comprehend this difference. Nine out of 10 parts of the human genome are non-coding. Only about 10% of the genome is encoding. So when the computer finds these differences, they're finding them in the 90% range of it doesn't matter. They're simply markers, but not anything which kind of code for, let's say, prostate cancer. So you may find that the computer will tell you the differences between population A and B, let's say black and white, shows up these patterns. But it is not necessarily going to tell you about prostate cancer. It just tells you that there's a superficial difference.
And we don't know whether that difference makes any makes any difference.
We don't know. That's right.
Well, is it, though, the case that if we take a look at groups of people, say we break them down by ethnicity, and we take a look at white Europeans and black Africans and Asians and Native Americans, and we compare, we put groups like that together and we compare that their DNA, and we come up with differences between the groups. If we did, is it also the case that we can find, let's say we'll start just comparing people to people, that you're still there is still significant, is there still significant variability from one person to the next, within those groups, and start just comparing one black guy to another black guy to another black guy, rather than comparing black men and white men, and so you're going to find significant differences within those groups as well.
Definitely. That is, we still have this mantra, which people will agree to, that there's an extraordinary amount of human variation within, quote, a racial group. So you're right to suggest that if you looked between, let's say, Europeans, between Croatians and Englishmen and Swedes, you'd find huge genetic variation. It's not just a matter of between, quote, two different racial groups. Mm.
Or if we just had a group that were all Englishmen, and we compared them one to another,
you'd find also variation.
We'd find differences.
But if you're looking for racial differences, again, with this in the non-coding region, you're going to find them. And let me comment here about the development which you might find of interest. Something called ancestral informative markers. Back in February, there was a four-part series on PBS by Skip Gates and his group at Harvard. And in part four, they tried to use the DNA analysis to determine whether or not particular African Americans could trace their DNA back to certain parts of Africa. And that program was quite well received. It got very high and very good reviews in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. But what it didn't get at was the fact that these ancestral markers are only a very small part of one's ancestry. Let me explain. We can go back on the Y chromosome to get father's DNA connected. That's how we got Thomas Jefferson connected to Sally Hemings. And we can go back on the mitochondrial side, the mother's 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 mother. So we had those two devices in the DNA. But what we cannot do is find anything in between. So we go back, let's say, six generations, we have, let's say, 128 people. We only can, on the DNA, find two. So now let's go back to this program. Now, the program suggested that you could find with Oprah Winfrey that she was or was not Zulu. But in fact, upon closer inspection, all we can say is that, based upon the technology, we can know whether or not her great-great-great-grandfather or grandmother on the other side was Zulu. We cannot, with any kind of definitiveness, determine whether or not with these markers one is or is not a part of any ancestry.
Hmm. Well, we're here moving into about our last 15 minutes. I have another caller here. Let's bring them in. Someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Truly wonderful topic. And I think this points out to something that at least anthropologists discuss, as do psychologists, that, you know, take, for example, our knowledge of blood typing, which goes back to, I believe, right before World War II. There are many different tissue types that affect blood typing. And in fact, actually, there's like seven or eight different typing systems for blood. And so, you know, when we look at distribution patterns of blood type in the United States, they follow, of course, these X things called racial stereotypes. But I think what we're going to find, and this is my own belief, it's obviously speculation, is that the true things that we can detect, first of all, are going to be related to non-essential genetic components, but that also there is so much variation within, quote, racial groups that very often you will have people in one racial group who are much more closer genetically to somebody, say, in a different genetic group. And we don't understand this now. We probably will 100 years from now, where someone in Europe may actually share more genetic, quote, material with somebody who they don't identify with racially. So I think it's
yes.
It's very interesting stuff, and thank you for debugging so much of bad genetics. But thank you. Bye-bye.
Right. Well, thank you. Let me comment on that, the issue around the ABO blood system. In the early part of the 20th century, a good part of the world of molecular biology, it wasn't called that then, it was called something else, was engaged in this attempt, mainly in Germany, but also in other parts of Europe, to associate the ABO blood system with racial categories, with racial groups. And they tried for over 20 years, between about 1905 to 1925, and finally they gave up. So your caller is exactly right. The assumption was that ABO or any other blood system would track along, quote, common sense racial lines. It did not.
We certainly have time for other questions as we continue to talk with our guest, Troy Duster. He's a professor of sociology at NYU and has written a lot and spoken a lot, has often asked to comment on these kinds of issues in dealing with race and ethnicity, also science and sociology of knowledge. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Another area that I'd like to have you talk a little bit about, and this has to do with the observed tendencies of certain people to have certain kinds of health problems. Going to this issue of race, is it scientifically valid as an idea, or is this mostly a social construct? And that we tend to sort of think of those two things as separate. That is, whatever kind of scientific validity the idea of race has, that's one set of things. As a social construct, it's another set of things. I think one of the things that you really argued is that you have to consider how those two things might be connected.
Yes.
By people's real life experience, and has we don't want to minimize racism by saying race is a social construct. We have to acknowledge the fact that that influences people's how people live their lives, and that influences their health, and so that it's tangled up in a way that I think sometimes we don't always acknowledge.
I'm glad you bring that up, because that's one of the key issues in this debate, and health disparities and ethnicity and race, which is a big topic these days. The NIH mandated research to be done on racial differences, racial and ethnic differences with health. And what they were after, obviously, was this long history of a lack of attention to these differences. But here I think you're fundamentally onto something important, that is, race is a very complex concept, and once you start talking about, let's use the example of hypertension. It's the best one I can think of. People, let's say, become hypertense for all kinds of reasons. Some of it may be biological and genetic in origin, but it's also the case that we know that based upon some social circumstances, one becomes more or less hypertense. So in the United States, given the history of racism, we know that blacks are, for example, more likely to be pulled over by the police when they're going to department stores to be followed around. When they go to get a bank loan, they're less likely to get one because of redlining. I could go on with this list for a long time, but the point is that these kinds of social circumstances could produce a condition which was biological, namely increased hypertension. Then we move to the level of the biological analysis, and people could say, well, since blacks are more hypertense than whites, must be that it is, quote, genetic. Well, one could distinguish between a biological outcome and a genetic basis, and that confusion, I think, is out there in the literature. So what I've been trying to suggest in my work is that we need to have a kind of sophisticated anthropology of science and of medicine, where we don't simply say, over here we have race, over here we have racist biology, over here we have racist social. The impact of a society upon those at the very base, where you're trying to, let's say, understand their health outcomes, might well be this interplay that you mentioned at the outset. A good example for your, again, listeners would be the caste system. For 3,000 years we've had the caste system. Well, the chances are pretty good that people at the very bottom of the caste system are going to have different health problems than those who are at the top for all kinds of reasons. But it could be this kind of combination of feedback loop between being at the bottom of a social structure and also having a kind of impact upon one's physiology and physiognomy.
Yeah. We have some other callers who will try to get them in the time that remains. Going next to someone, I believe, in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm not sure this question is related to what you've been talking about, but I've heard a lot about biological warfare recently, and I'm wondering if someone somewhere is trying to develop some kind of weapon that would distinguish among races of people, or is this simply like during World War One, they used mustard gas and all kinds of chemicals that would kill off people of any race?
Mm-hmm. Well, your question is not exactly off the mark. There have been three or four articles published in the last decade in which there's been a charge that certain scientists are looking for patterns in the DNA. They're called single nucleotide polymorphisms, which are peculiar to particular groups. Mm. And if that were found and one could find a kind of intervention biologically to go after those particular patterns, one could have a device which was obviously, as you said, useful in biological warfare. But that's very much at the margins. I mean, I don't think very much has been written about that. There are only a few articles in the last decade, and they're at the fringe of science. They're not at the hardcore, and as we now know, a lot of what happens in government procedures like in the CIA or in the old KGB, we don't know for about 30 or 40 years, so we won't know the answer to your question if it's going on.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Line three is next. This is someone listening in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. You almost beat me to the caller two people ago about this business of whether the correlation, it's pure correlation or whether it's causation. And I was wondering if you found any hypothesis that's really good. In other words, are there any cases that have been discovered where a race really has been shown to be causative and not just a correlation due to God knows what? I remember being an undergraduate, and psychology professor was a statistics professor, and he said, you know, one of the strongest statistics that every year that is brought up is that more people die who buy Mercedes than buy Mercedes. I'm sorry, they buy Volkswagens.
Mm-hmm. Well,
maybe more. But what is it about owning a Mercedes that makes you have a heart attack? And the class, they're going, it's obvious that they have a different lifestyle. They're more type A personality and hard driven and all that stuff. And that's what I was asking, if you've ever found a case where the race really has been shown to be truly causative.
I think the answer is definitively no. What you're going to get is high correlations. Mm-hmm. And then once you have a high correlation, let's say, between prostate cancer and race, the question will be then what kinds of controls you're going to use in a scientific model to tease out what might be the cause.
Right.
But there are no studies that I know which have ever made the claim that race is the cause of a health outcome.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Belgium, nearby, at line number four. Hello.
Hello. I thought I'd like to bring into the topic probably the most basic aspect of this, and I'll use Mr. Inge and I as an example. Mr. Inge hears my voice very regularly on this radio show, but yet I don't expect ever to be invited to the Christmas party. We're always going to be in two different groups. And it seems though we as people are always looking for some way to segregate us from somebody else, whether it may be by race or by position in the workforce or relationship like Mr. Inge and I have, just a fan and a radio announcer. Maybe that's the real basis of this entire problem.
Well, I think that simplifies a very complex issue. Namely, we are both inclined towards making differences between ourselves, and under certain conditions, which are social, we come together. So once you have a common enemy, what you thought was your problem in terms of ethnic and racial or gender differences can really float away. I mean, we see this in earthquakes, we see it in hurricanes, we see it all the time in wars, where people who thought they were in different categories, all of a sudden they become Americans and they're fighting Germans. The other thing is also true, of course. People who thought that they were Serbian or Croatian in one moment to find themselves in a huge battle, and then in the next century they're living peacefully in Sarajevo. So I think we can't simply say humans looking for differences. Under conditions which are social and political and economic, humans also look for commonness.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. And let's go to line one for another caller. This is someone back in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Is it true that blacks did not get yellow fever or die from it, and Caucasians, on the other hand, did? Or was this some other, was there another reason other than race there?
I don't know the particular history of cholera and yellow fever to be able to give you a definitive answer on that one. I know enough to tell you that African Americans and whites died of cholera and yellow fever in very high numbers in the middle and late part of the 19th century. So there was, if there was a difference, it wasn't a dramatic one in terms of race.
Okay. All right, thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. Well, we're coming down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. Let me ask you this question. Suppose that I was a physician, and I said, it's my goal as a physician to try to get to know my patients and to treat them as individuals and as whole persons, as much as today's medical practice will allow me the time to do that. So so as I'm sitting down and trying to get to know the patients and consider who they are and trying to figure out what's going on with them, as I try to consider everything that they are, how in what way do I take race into account? How do I even get that into the mix?
Yeah, I think in a society in which race is an important category, people's access to resources and whether it's schools, as I said earlier, to bank loans. I mean, I don't think it's possible to simply say we're colorblind, that we should acknowledge that race is an important feature of our lives. Whether we then move to the next level in terms of understanding race as a concept that's primarily about our biology or physiology is a whole different matter. But I think as a physician, we, as analysts, need to think about where people are as whole beings in their social world. So I think, and I'm pretty clear about this one, I don't think physicians should be, quote, colorblind. I think they should take into account, but be very careful of the what I'll call the tightrope between reifying race as a biological category and seeing people in some kind of a larger social matrix.
Hmm. And as far as the subject that we started with, you know, going back to where the growing field of pharmacogenomics, the idea that you could take a look at individuals at a genetic level and learn some things about them, about their propensity for disease, and then tailor therapies accordingly.
I think is a big leap and a big mistake.
Uh-huh.
I think that what we need to do is to see people in terms of their social connections to the world, and indeed race is important there. And as I said, hypertension or other kinds of manifestations of illness might come out of the fact that one is in the racial category. But the mistake is to conclude that therefore one can understand what's happening only in terms of the biology of race.
Yeah. I would expect that in terms of potential for making money, on the one hand, by pharmaceutical companies, on the other, by people who do this kind of research, the idea of learning new things, that somehow both the quest for knowledge and the quest for profits, we should expect that should continue to drive that.
It will, and I also should say at the very end here that I don't want to impugn the motives of those who are doing good work in medical fields. I mean, there are black physicians who take strong issue with this analysis and say, well, of course we should have Bidil out there for black people. It's a good thing. My response to that is, fine, let's keep it on the market and let's not racialize it.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point because I think it is true that, for example, you know, the Association of Black Cardiologists, when Bidil came out, they all said, this is fine.
They thought this is a good thing.
So they were not against it.
The Black Caucus came out in favor of it, and the NAACP. So this is not a question of people who are, quote, of color objecting on racist terms. My objection has to do with what I call the false reality of race.
Yeah, and does that the false reality? I mean, it seems that genetic science here actually has some potential for pumping some new life into that.
Yes, indeed. And perhaps we're coming to the close here, but let me just close with my fear fantasy.
Yes.
Incarceration rates are extraordinarily distorted in this country by race. So I think the ratio is now 8-1, black to white. So if one is going to go into the prisons and look at, and quote, a study of felons or armed robbers or violent criminals, one can find in the DNA certain patterns. And my concern is that with this whole notion that we can give reality to race at a biological level, it sort of sets us up for going into what is clearly a social circumstance, namely our incarceration rate, and coming out with an analysis which is biological. We go back to 1925, the ratio is only 2-1, black to white. 1995, it's 8-1. Genes don't close off, genes don't change in that kind of a 60-year period. So it's obviously a social race that's operating.
Well, we will have to stop there because we have come to the end of the time. Our guest, Troy Duster, he's professor of sociology at NYU. If you'd like to read some of his writing on the subject, you might look for the book Backdoor to Eugenics, published by Routledge, and it's in its second edition, came out in 2003. Professor Duster, we want to say to you, thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for the invitation.